Welcome back to the program. How many times have you heard an old song that brought you back to a particular place and time? The music acted as a kind of transport device that allowed you to short-circuit time and make yesterday's events today's reality. But what impact does this have on the music and the pop culture in general? If the past is what makes us comfortable in music and art and fashion, where do we find the creativity to move us forward? What will inspire the creative destruction for our future art and popular culture? This is what we're going to talk about today with my guest, Simon Reynolds. Simon Reynolds is a music critic. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Village Voice, Rolling Stone, and others. It is my pleasure to welcome Simon Reynolds here to talk about Retromania. Simon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Has this always been the case, this fascination with kind of retro things, old music, old fashion, or is there something more contemporary about it?
Well, it's certainly true. As I, you know, one part of the book is looking at the present situation, and another a big section of it is actually looking back at pop's own tradition of looking back at its own past. So I talk about things like there's a big 50s revival in the 70s. In the 80s, there was a lot of, you know, obsession with the 60s. It's almost like a 20-year thing that became inbuilt in rock music. And it's also true that, you know, musicians have always drawn inspiration from the past. I think what's different about the current situation is it relates to the influence of the internet. I think has made this the past a lot more instantly available, and a lot of it for people who download illegally, you know, they can just drown in the past of the music and just kind of explore it to their heart's content.
And now with things like Spotify and RDO, it's just all there at the click of a mouse.
So, yeah, I mean, if you want to be a good citizen and you know, pay for your music, which some people do, there are plenty of ways of having the same kind of experience of just, you know, exploring decade upon decade of pop music drifting across time, really. And, you know, and then the things like YouTube is an amazing cultural phenomenon. It's like this giant, collectively assembled archive of music and video. Particularly interesting to me is how it's become like an audio library, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff up there where people have primarily put the song up there and they put like a still image or a sort of very cheaply made little moving image thing they've made themselves, but really it's you go to it to consult it as a sound library.
Right.
But also you have things like, I mean, it's fantastic for me as someone who grew up in England in the 70s, someone has put up all these TV commercials that we used to love as kids and sing in the playground, and then TV commercials were sort of kind of cultural touchstones, weirdly, in a way they aren't now. They're actually like, because, you know, they were cult. There was sort of love for particular TV commercials that were very quirky or odd. So, you know, it's great that all this stuff is up there, but it does mean that the whole sprawl of pop culture is so much more available than it was before the internet. And I think it's almost become mesmerizing to young musicians. Like, I think they think much more about finding out things from the past and reworking them or coming up with a twist on them.
Mm-hmm.
Than trying to do something that's never been heard before.
Of course, the other part of this is the way in which the memories of all of this get coated with a certain gloss by virtue of memory, the way they're misremembered in some cases, and have a patina that is really undeserved.
Yeah, totally. The myths build up on stuff, and, you know, there is a sort of endless retelling of these sort of golden periods of music history, endless documentaries on the 60s, on punk rock, you know, films, biopics, books, issues of magazines. So a lot of the sway that these past eras of music have on younger musicians is based on these sort of encrusted myths, and this sort of subliminal message of a lot of it is saying those were the days, and the present can't compare. And, you know, I do think quite a few younger people, younger musicians, do languish a bit under this sort of born too late feeling.
Right. What about all, with respect again to the technology, that it's gotten to the point where being able to have access to it, all of this stuff from the past, is actually more important than even listening to it?
Well, I think that's what I find. I mean, when one of the things I look at with in my book Retromania is how it is, a lot of it's based on my own experiences of using music and how I'm rampantly acquiring it in vast amounts than ever before. And I, having been a music journalist for 25 years, I'm used to having a lot of traffic of records being sent to me and arriving mm-hmm. in the house and piling up. But this is like a whole new factor of excess. And a lot of it is, you know, I hunt for obscure records on the internet and download them, and they just pile up and I never get around to listening to them. And it's almost like the thrill of, it's that old idea of the thrill of the purchase, you know, like the people who are compulsive shopaholics, you know,
right.
and it's the purchase of the moment, I think is the actual term, isn't it, where you get that buzz in the store, but then you might end up with a closet full of clothes you never actually wear. Well, this is like that, except no money's being spent, you know, so it's even, it's just pure sort of kind of consumerism. I think there's a limit to how much you can feel music. If you're trying to listen to so much music, you only listen to things once. You know, you don't really get that immersive experience of it, and you don't bond with it in the same way either. So,
it used to be that for younger generations, at least, that part of what creativity was about was tearing down, or at least dramatically changing, altering what came before, as opposed to embracing what came before.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that sort of reflex, the sort of generational animus, that kind of sort of, you know, kill the father kind of impulse, or at least, you know, reject the father's and the mother's music, you know, that's gone. I mean, like, a good example is this band Fleet Fox, their whole style is based around records they found in their parents' collections. Their parents were kind of hippie generation people and had the band and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Joni Mitchell and Fairport Convention in their collections. And the sons, you know, loved the music and started a band based around that thing. Often you find now with music festivals, the big music festivals that are bigger than ever, especially in the UK, but here too, you find that it's parents go to them and they bring their sort of teenage children with them sometimes. And they're both enjoying the same kind of music.
How much of it do you think has to do with the ongoing narcissism of baby boomers?
I think, you know, obviously the baby boomers have controlled the media for a while, and I guess the sort of the tail end of the baby boom generation is actually the punk generation as well, and it's like the two sort of eras that are most mythologized. The 60s wins by, you know, a huge amount, but then punk and new wave also has a kind of a legendary aura that, you know, has been constantly replayed and told. And perhaps in a little while, you know, a generation will come forward and start going on about grunge. I mean, I think there's the beginnings of a 90s revival going on, and this year there's going to be a lot of talk about Nirvana and grunge and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe every generation will, as they rise up through the ranks of media and, you know, publishing and all these things, cultural industries, they're inevitably going to start commissioning books or documentaries about stuff they really cared about, you know. So maybe it's not such a sinister thing, it's just a reflection of how people, you know, every year a lot of books about Dylan are written and published, and or the Beatles, and that's partly because of the super eminence they have in the history of pop music. But it's also partly because, you know, people in positions of power grew up with that music, and they, you know, they want to commission more books like that. They want to read another book.
Right. The other part of it is that this same phenomenon is happening not just in music, but it's happening in so many other areas of popular culture. It's happening in fashion, it's happening in movies, on Broadway, etc., and in art.
Yes, I think I think retro is a culture-wide paradigm, and it's really, you know, it's filtered down to bizarre places. Like, for instance, my daughter is in camp. She's 5. They had an 80s day the other day, and my daughter, you know, didn't know what it was about. You know, she said the counselors were dressed really strangely, camp counselors. Perhaps one of them was dressed as Boy George. I don't know, but you know, it is. You know, you can go and buy retro sweets, retro candy. You can buy, you know, it's even retro porn is like a phenomenon. So it's sort of across the board. I think it's particularly strong in music because there's just something about the way that pop music moves so fast for a long time. It left behind a lot of styles that you could revisit and get some more value out of or nutrition out of, because they were passed through pretty quickly, but they could be explored some more. And I think it's particularly common I think fashion actually was really the pioneering, the first major sort of popular art form where people started sort of recycling ideas. And that, again, is partly to do with the way the fashion has to keep moving so fast. And it's actually kind of hard to come up with new ideas that aren't completely unwearable, you know. It's easy to come up with extreme clothing that, you know, will make you a sensation on the runway, but they won't actually be worn. So if you want to stay within the bounds of what's wearable, yet keep changing every season, you kind of have to start revisiting the past. So you get designers who use historical ideas, like Vivienne Westwood would go through history books looking for ideas, but you also get a lot of designers, you know, I spoke to a fashion theorist, professor of fashion. She said that people in fashion started reviving the 80s almost as soon as the decade ended. You know, like in the early 90s, you started to get, you know, the first of several back to the 80s things within fashion. And you've had grunge, you know, you've had grunge revivals of the grunge look in fashion, goth. It's almost inbuilt into the way fashion works.
I wonder how much of it is kind of a fashion that is a reaction against the speed at which fashion, whether it's in music or in clothing, the speed at which it moves, because you can argue that you don't have to be up to date, you just deal with stuff that's out of date already.
Well, I think the reaction there is probably takes the form of this thing, you know, people talk about vintage chic, and that I actually came across, I quote it in Retromania, there's a boutique, a chain of boutiques actually in Britain that specialise in vintage clothes, and their slogan is something like, don't bother to keep up with fashion, buy something that's already out of date. So the idea is that I think that what it does is it's kind of flattering, it appeals to a certain kind of person who wants to, you know, who enjoys buying things and expressing themselves through clothes or interior decor or whatever, but doesn't necessarily want to go to IKEA, doesn't necessarily want to go to, you know, Main Street or shopping mall. This is a bit more like being a connoisseur, because you go to these stores, and serious vintage people wouldn't go to a boutique that sold vintage, they would go to flea markets and thrift stores and things like that, do it themselves. But, you know, the idea is it's a bit more discriminating. You're actually, what you're buying was once mass-produced mainstream stuff, but there's an element of, you know, you're sifting through a lot of stuff that might be kind of drecky, but your finely tuned eye spots something that's kind of cool in a quaint sort of way, and then you're expressing yourself more than if you're just going to the shopping mall.
What impact is it having creatively, as you see it, then, in the world of music? What is this doing to calcify any kind of creative destruction to move contemporary music forward?
Well, there's just a lot of bands whose styles are very easily pegged to previous styles of music and very closely replicate them. But the other thing is the bands are very aware of that, and, you know, they will offer up, if you interview these bands or you read an interview with them, they tend to have a laundry list of influences. Like, they reel out what they were trying to do. They're very conscious of this process. And it's almost like they go shopping for influences, and they're presenting like a portfolio of their influences. And if you think about it, that's a complete change in the idea of influence, because influence used to be something that was fairly involuntary. You would influence by your upbringing or your things you were exposed to, or, you know, Soul Singer would have been influenced by going to church and hearing church music, gospel. But now bands often construct a kind of sonic identity themselves by sort of actually going out seeking esoteric influences and combining them, stuff like that. I think that could be done quite creatively. I don't necessarily think the orientation to the past is always, you know, it doesn't always generate lame, uninteresting music. Some of the most creative, you know, one of my favorite musicians is this guy, Ariel Pink, and his music's very based around sort of 70s radio rock, 80s new wave, and kind of playing with the idea of the golden age of radio and stuff like that. And he's a fantastic musician, but I think the trouble is that it does, you don't get that sort of shock of the new, of the shock of something that seems to come out of nowhere. It doesn't happen very often anymore.
Is there much going on that is new?
I haven't found much. I mean, there's sort of desperately obscure little scenes in dance music that are really cool and weird, but, you know, they're a long, long way from the mainstream, and they're really a long way from sort of even the alternative world of consensus of magazines like Pitchfork, you know, and Spin and things like that. It's if you look at the bulk of what's in the charts, the pop charts, you know, you have things like Adele, which is a 45-year-old style of music, CeeLo Green, still on the radio, and that was, you know, based around 70s soul. And then you have an awful lot of music that sounds like 90s sort of pop club music, European pop techno. That's virtually everything in the charts now is like that, you know, from Pitbull to Britney Spears. And there doesn't seem to be a defining, groundbreaking sound that is pop music. And that's a pretty new thing because, you know, certainly in the 90s you had a lot of electronic music that was innovative, that was in the charts. You had a lot of really interesting R&B and hip-hop that was innovative, that was right at the top of the charts. And it's really like this last decade has been the one where there hasn't really been a new phenomenon on the scale of a hip-hop or a electronica.
I mean, when you look at it, does one style of music supplant another as we go through the generations, or is there some kind of evolutionary process?
Well, I always thought there was, but I don't know if that applies anymore. I think one of the things that's interesting is that all these styles of music stick around, you know, like there's heavy metal is still with us, and it's sort of it's got actually broken up into scores and scores of little subgenres, and you know, they have names like doom metal and black metal, and there's even retro doom metal. You know, it gets very specific. And then virtually every style of music has its current adherents, its current fans. So there's a big sprawl, I think, of music culture. And quite a lot of it is people operating in genres that really have pretty much stuck, you know, they've pretty much gone static. And then there are other people who are involved in things that are just overtly revivalist, you know, overtly based around a particular era. And, you know, often they're quite good. I mean, there's a group called Tame Impala who made a really great record, but it's very much like my brother said to me, he's a fan of theirs, and he said, this is like they've decided that Paperback Writer by the Beatles was the ultimate pinnacle of pop music, and they just decided to stay there and sort of stretch it out a bit longer. And, you know, and it's a great record, but it's not giving you that, it's not giving you the feeling that the Beatles records would have given you when they first came out, which is like, wow, I've never heard this before.
Are there things happening that you see in other parts of the culture? We talked a little bit about fashion. Are there things happening in other parts of popular culture that are kind of reinforcing this lack of creativity, this looking to the past?
Well, you know, in movies, obviously there's a lot of remakes and a lot of, or if not literal remakes, then things that are kind of based around, you know, like the Smurfs or Yogi Bear, you know, they're not exact remakes of a pre-existing movie like some remakes are, but they're based on a nostalgia-surrounded old thing that a lot of people remember and feel fondly about. I was going to write about that in the book, but I decided it wasn't that interesting a film because I think it's primarily business-driven. I think it's, I don't think there are really profound cultural reasons for it. I think it's a lot of studio executives think it's a safe option. They have this term, a pre-sold concept.
Right.
Because, you know, people know what it is. younger people might be vaguely excited just because they see the trailer for it, and they vaguely know what it is. Older people will be like, oh, yeah, I used to like that. And it's a good way of getting, you know, you almost guaranteed a certain number of people will come out for a remake movie.
And that's been going on for a while, so one wonders if music in some way isn't copying that, if the same principles are beginning to apply, that music is kind of the last area of popular culture to pick up on that same phenomenon.
It might be that music held out longest against this kind of phenomenon. I think remakes in movies, although they existed in the past in the sense that you might have, like the movie High Society was a musical version of the Philadelphia Story, wasn't it, I think?
Right.
And you did have certain remakes, but I think as a sort of huge, huge phenomenon, it's a relatively new thing in cinema history, like probably really got going in a big way in the 90s, and it's just sort of become almost a structural part of the movie industry. When people aren't feeling terribly inspired or they need something that's going to, like, bring a certain guaranteed box office in, you know, they go for the remake. And you get a bit of remakes going on in TV as well, but they don't seem to do as well. They don't seem to... A lot of them, you know, there's a lot of fanfare, and then they get cancelled halfway through the season. My sense where retro is the biggest is music, it's fashion. It's very big in design world, graphic design and interior deco and things like that. There are other parts of the culture where there isn't really an equivalent, I don't think there's an equivalent of retro fiction. You don't have people writing in the style of Faulkner or Dickens so much, I don't think.
To what extent do you think that any of this that we've been talking about with respect to the music is driven by economics?
I think it could well be that the record industry, especially that it's so besieged by problems in the last decade with file sharing and all other changes, and the economy being shaky and people probably having less money to spend, they might very well be being more cautious in terms of signing artists who do something that's already known to be loved. You know, for instance, you know, Adele, she's obviously talented and has good songs and all that. It's a fairly safe thing for a record company to get behind because it's a style of music that's, you know, has transgenerational, cross-generational appeal and it fits our ideas of what pop music should be. They'd be less, you know, it makes sense that was a big popular success as well, you know, people going for what's not too demanding, not too risky as a purchase. Usually the way that creativity or new sounds come is they come up from below, and then the record industry kind of picks up on them. So I suppose what's interesting to me is why new sounds aren't coming up from sort of the left field or the street scenes, you know, so much as they used to. And I think that's partly because I think there's this sort of been this shift amongst the kind of people who were doing sort of more groundbreaking innovative music in the past, that sort of class, as it were, much more fascinated by the past, you know, talking about sort of young, hip people, it's sort of in every aspect from wearing vintage clothes to the way they might have a vintage manual typewriter as a decorative object in their living room, to the kind of approach they have to music, which is sort of piecing together a style using elements from the past. Or doing pastiches of retro styles. It's all of a piece. And from that, I conclude that they're not thinking about, let's do something futuristic or that's never been done before. They're thinking of, they're much more fascinated. There's a kind of romance towards the past, I think.
Right.
Because there's so much of it. It's so accessible in terms of the internet that you can also, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there in the world in thrift stores and flea markets you can sift through. I always, there's a sort of crass analogy that I sometimes use, which is, you know, the kind of people who would have had a lava lamp in the 60s now have a vintage typewriter. So I think that says something. That's a cultural shift. And you can see that with things like steampunk, you know, that whole scene is, you know, it's not, they're not dressing how they imagine the future would be. They're dressing in this sort of fantasy Victorian past that isn't the real Victorian past, but it's like a sort of, it's different, but a futuristic way of being different.
And is this an international phenomenon?
Yeah, it's a huge international phenomenon in the Western world, I guess. It's in America, Britain, Europe, Australia. You know, it's a sort of the dominant mode of thinking about music, I think.
And is it your sense, having covered the music scene for so long, that this too will be a passing phase, and that we will get to a point of greater creativity?
Well, I certainly hope so. I don't know. I think that's one question. I at the start of Retromania, I pose a bunch of questions, and that's one. Most of the questions I actually answer. That's one of the ones I don't have an answer for because I don't have a crystal ball. But I do feel it's a sort of a gut feeling that this has to break. I people are now talking about a 90s revival, and I don't see how we can just go ahead and punctually have a noughties revival. You know, yeah. There seems to be this 20-year gap, and come 2017, 2018, people will, you know, things go on the way they are. People will be tentatively dipping their toes in the potential noughties revival, and I just can't see that, you know, that happening. I don't know what they would revive, because so much of the last decade was based around things like, you know, 80s revivalism or, you know, all kinds of other revivals, and I don't know what they would go back to find to revive. So it seems like something has to break in this system, this sort of nostalgia industry. But who knows? It could just go on. I think one of the things with commemoration and nostalgia is that it's a sort of it's a good way for concert promoters to make money when they have reunions, and it's magazine. It fills up magazine space. There's a sort of kind of a structural imperative to have issues of magazines that are about remembering punk, right, or remembering Woodstock, or having the top 500 singles of all time, these endless sort of lists about the past. Because, you know, they take up space, and they fill up, they fill up media space.
Simon Reynolds, his book is Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. Simon, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.